Good afternoon. Call to order the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water for Thursday. Welcome, committee. Before we get to our main agenda, I'm going to note that we will carry over one more time. I don't know if they're in the room. We're in Paint Care and DEQ. Hopefully they're out in the hall listening. We're carrying over one more time House Bill 2191 to Tuesday. If we've been unable to reach resolution on that by Tuesday, we'll need to schedule it for a work session with 48-hour notice for some future point in the session. But we'll give them one more shot to Tuesday to kind of work through those issues with Representative Gilliam and other members of the committee. So that done, let me open an informational meeting to discuss ocean energy. And we have two panels that we have invited to speak to us today. And the first will be Jason Bush, Paul Claren, and Robert Lurie. Just so folks know, we've dedicated a half an hour of today's agenda to this informational hearing. It's not a lot. We have six people. 30 divided by 6 is 5, but that wouldn't leave any time for questions. So it could be 5 minutes each, and committees like to ask questions. They might feel, you know, like that's 5 is too long. So I encourage you to actually keep it even shorter than 5 minutes, and that will allow the committee then to follow up with you. So if that first panel could join us, and
let's see first.
I don't know if we want to have any introductory comments from members of our coastal caucus here who are most directly involved in wave energy projects. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to thank everybody on these two panels and the people in the room who've come to talk to us about this today, just to kind of bring us up to speed on what's happening. And Mr. Lurie came probably the farthest. He came from the other side of the country. And this has been going on for a while. I'm not going to take their time or anything, but this is really cutting-edge stuff that we're doing here, and I'm really happy to have the people here who've been doing this for quite a while and let us know what's happening in Oregon and what's likely to happen. So,
great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, if I am, I'll need the screen because I have a PowerPoint.
Okay.
It was funny, you all looked to the other one, and Paul, there was nobody there.
There we go.
I've got it on my screen. Well, my name is Paul Claren. I'm the Marine Affairs Coordinator for the State of Oregon. I'm in the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I'm going to lead you through what we are currently up to, which is amending the state's territorial sea plan for renewable energy development, and I'll do this fast and furious to keep under that 5 minutes. So, how we got here. Governor's executive order back in March 2008, because there was a lot of activity, preliminary permits to FERC for renewable energy development on the coast, a lot of concern in coastal communities, the fishing community, environmental groups. The governor issued an executive order that required us to amend the territorial sea plan for renewable energy development. At the same time, on the very same day, the state of Oregon signed an agreement with FERC, an MOU, FERC being the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, on how the state and FERC would work together in the permitting of these types of facilities. Since then, we have adopted Part 5 of the Territorial Sea Plan for renewable energy development. That is the policies, the evaluations, the different operation requirements for renewable energy development. What we haven't done are the maps. We're about to do that. Since then, we have a President Obama's executive order, which has federal agencies and states working on marine spatial planning nationwide. And we recently signed an agreement with the new Bureau of Ocean Energy Resource Management and Regulatory Enforcement. That's the successor to MMS, and that is the federal agency that regulates renewable energy. So that's what's happened. What we're doing now is implementing the Territorial Sea Plan and amending it. This is the background for it. Goal 19, Ocean Resources, mandates that we protect marine habitat and areas important to fisheries. We have the existing Oregon Territorial Sea Plan, state agency authorities, OPAC, which is the Ocean Policy Advisory Council created by ORS 196 to advise us on how to do that. What statewide planning goal 19 tells us to do is to protect renewable marine resources, i.e. living marine resources, that is the functional integrity of the ecosystem, areas important to fisheries, and existing uses. part two of that is now the mapping process. We have the policies in place. We are now going through an analytical process for actually finding the areas that are appropriate for renewable energy development. We're using all kinds of data we've collected in the last few years. This is some of the data. We've been working with the fishing community to identify those areas important to fisheries. We have collected a lot of ecological data from various sources. The state helped fund the C4 mapping project that went on for the last 2 years. There's a recreational ocean use project being was just finalized, and that was funded by foundations. And we have the human uses that are already out there. So there's a lot of data pieces that go into this. This is the process we're using. It's a very bottoms-up, stakeholder-driven process. It involves a lot of advisory groups at the local level. Some of them were created by counties. Some were quite organic. They are working through OPAC, the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, and the Territorial Sea Plan Advisory Committee that was created by my commission. There will be, over the next 6 months, anywhere from 15 to 20 meetings up and down the coast where we'll be going through this spatial analysis. They will be drafting maps and changes to the plan that will be forwarded to my commission, adopted into the Territorial Sea Plan. These maps will show areas that need to be protected as well as the areas that could be designated for renewable energy development. That will be incorporated into the statewide plan, and then we will ask the federal government to approve that as part of our plan. So this is a very intense, stakeholder-driven, bottoms-up type of process like we've never seen before. And it involves the industry, environmental groups, conservation groups, fishing industry, local governments. All the stakeholders are part of these committees and part of this process. This is the list of partners who are in on the process as we speak. Most of the funding has come from OET, maybe Jason will speak to that, and from foundations and from the federal government at this point. A whole lot of players, a whole lot of movement in place as we speak. This is just an illustration of how we're integrating the various overlays of spatial data that we're collecting and we'll be using for the planning process. And this, again, is another one of those great wiring diagrams. It shows the various moving parts, all the players, how it feeds together into different map overlays, how those map overlays will be combined and used in a new system that we built. Thank you, Representative Boone, for sponsoring House Bill 3633 in the last session. We built Marine Map with that money, and Marine Map will be used in those public work sessions and will be a permanent system that will be available online that allow you to visualize all this data and allow you to do the actual analysis. And as part of Marine Map, we developed a module for the industry that they can use for their own analysis of areas that are appropriate for the development in for different technologies. So OET actually provided half the funding to build Marine Map. So C4 mapping, thanks for the $1 million. We got $4 million match out of the feds to do that, and we were able to do 50% of our territorial sea. The fishing community has stepped up big time and participated with us in mapping the areas important to fisheries. This is something new for the fishing community to be on board as a participant and a partner in this type of effort. This is probably the first time where they're in control of their own destiny, and I think it's new for all of us. It's not without its challenges, but it's working so far. This is the kind of map that we'll be generating. We'll be including ecological data sets, managed areas, some of the human uses. On this particular one, you see dredge material disposal sites, you see cable landings, you see the actual OPT permit application on the North Spit, you see navigation channels, you see various environmental and ecological areas. And we'll be going through a mapping process like this that allows us to eventually find areas where there is no conflict of use and perhaps designate them for renewable energy development. This is one of the fisheries maps combined with some ecological maps in Marine Map that sort of gives you an idea about how these things will start to look. We'll begin that process very soon. In a couple of weeks, in fact, we'll be meeting in Newport and schedule for ourselves a series of meetings in the next 6 months up and down the coast at which we'll actually figure out where it's best to designate areas for renewable energy development, and at the same time, what are those areas we need to protect for fisheries and as ecological resources. And that is the fast and furious version of
that was
a
great.
Lot.
Appreciate you
a
packing
lot.
It in. Thanks. Well, I'm going to suggest that we move on and hear next from you.
Thank you. Chair Cannon, Chair Gillian, members of the committee. My name is Jason Bush. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust. We're a private nonprofit that receives funding from the Oregon Innovation Council, and our mission is to promote the responsible development of ocean energy in Oregon. And by responsible, we think of that primarily as ensuring that ocean energy is installed in a way that is environmentally sensitive and in a way that is respectful of the existing ocean users, primarily the fishing community. I think the most interesting thing you're going to hear today is coming from the folks who have traveled from the coast that will be impacted by ocean energy and stand to significantly benefit from it. So I'm going to keep my comments very short. You have a two-pager. I'm happy to answer any questions. Oregon's in a unique spot. We're really teed up to take advantage of ocean energy. We're different than the rest of the world because of the fact that we have all the factors in place necessary to attract an industry here. There's other places that have better ocean resources. Alaska has better wave resources, but they don't have the grid infrastructure along the coast like we do. They don't have the manufacturing base like American Bridge and Oregon Iron Works that can build these contraptions that are extremely large, very heavy, and has to be constructed near the site of deployment. Our grid on the coast can absorb almost 500 megawatts of new generation now without any major upgrades to the system. And I think you might hear a little bit more about that from some following speakers. And also, we want it here. This is a potentially a fantastic source of clean, renewable energy. And perhaps more importantly, ultimately, an amazing source of economic development for our state. OET has contracted with Eco Northwest to study this topic. And the numbers that came back from Eco Northwest are fantastic. And, for example, when a mature industry is established in this state 15 or 20 years from now, we expect to add about 13,000 jobs to the Oregon economy. And that's about $2.5 billion annually. A mature industry, what does that mean? That means an industry that's gone through the R&D phase, that's deployed about 500 megawatts of generation, and has begun to export their technology, their expertise, their knowledge to other states and the rest of the world. It becomes a traded sector at that point. We would like to be for ocean energy here in Oregon what Germany is for solar, what Denmark is for wind. There are some great things happening on the ground right now. Ocean Power Technologies, Bob Lurie has traveled from New Jersey. I was going to talk about that, but I think he can talk to it better than I can. Obviously, they're leading the pack here and moving forward in a great manner. We're very pleased that they're working with us. Columbia Power Technologies is a company you might not have heard of. They're actually an Oregon-based company that grew out of technology from Oregon State University. They have 10 employees in Corvallis, and they probably should have been on the roster today, but it's pretty full already. And for that matter, they're busy because this week they're deploying a 1/7 scale device up in Puget Sound. They picked Puget Sound only because they needed a wave regime that was relative in size to their device. It would have been swamped by Oregon's wave regime. Aquamarine is another company that's moving forward in the state. They have the Oyster device. It's a nearshore device, and they have recently opened an office in Oregon, in Newport, and they have a local employee who represents the company. They're a Scottish-based company. And these companies are all at different levels of technology development, and they're all working closely with folks up and down the coast to make sure that all this industry moves forward in a way that's respectful of the coastal communities. On that front, you know, OET takes very seriously how this industry could potentially affect folks on the coast, and that's why we are highly supportive of the fishing industry. We fund many of the groups along the coast, including FINE, FACT, SOURCE, Oregon Sea Grant, OCZMA, and FishGrid. I would lie to you, but I don't really know what all that stands for, about half of them. And these are groups that we've helped to give a political voice to so they could participate in the process and ensure that ocean energy moves forward in a way that minimizes potential impact for the fishing industry. We find areas of opportunity to make sure this is a win-win situation. There are still some hurdles we face. For example, Representative Boone's got a bill before you today, 2748. This bill is absolutely necessary for ocean energy to move forward in the state. There is a de facto moratorium on ocean hydro if we don't get an exemption from this rule or from this law. And also, Aquamarine, for example, they're moving forward with deploying some devices that test the wave regime along the coast, and they've run into some snags in at the regulatory level with the Department of State Lands. We're trying to work through that. But this is all new to virtually everyone, and it's a slow process. We get it, and we're working diligently to keep the process moving forward. That's all I've got for you. Thank you.
I just want to clarify that you said if one is looking for small waves, one should go to Puget Sound.
That's right.
One wants large waves, Oregon's the place to be.
That's the place.
Okay, great.
The CPT is looking to deploy their next device in the next 3 to 4 years, and that'll be a full-scale device.
Great. Great. Well, Mr. Lurie, you've traveled far to be here. We appreciate it.
And let's see, I'm looking for my presentation on here. I can't find it, so.
Uh-oh. I need it. 12-year-old to come down and
exactly. Maybe somebody who has this computer can help. In the meantime, I'll start. Good afternoon to the committee, Chairman Cannon, Chairman Gillum, and other members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to appear here today. I'd love to have the opportunity to talk about wave energy in Oregon and talk about our project in particular at Reedsport. My name is Bob Lurie. I'm Vice President of North American Business Development for Ocean Power Technologies. We're a U.S.-based company.
Do you know what it's called? Because it should be up there.
Douglas?
It wasn't called any of those.
I'm going to put it on there.
None
of those. Okay. Ocean Power Technologies is a global company. We're headquartered here in the U.S. We're doing work in Japan and Australia, in Europe, and Oregon is our most important market in North America by far. We're doing some work in Hawaii as well. That's in an earlier stage. Oregon is going to be the first commercial type of wave energy project that has been done anywhere in the world, and we are certainly the most, we consider ourselves the world leader in producing this kind of equipment, and are certainly the most mature company. We're the only wave energy company that's a public company. We went public on the NASDAQ in 2007. Oregon, as Jason Bush said, has an incredible opportunity to establish itself at the still early stage in the development of the wave energy industry as the world leader in wave energy. And that window of opportunity is going to be small. Of 104 wave energy companies worldwide, only 14 are headquartered in the U.S. We're one of those 14, and we're the largest of those 14. Jason explained why Oregon is the best potentially market in the world for this. So I won't repeat that, but we are focusing on Reedsport, Oregon, as the first commercial prototype of a wave power station in the world. We're using utility-scale equipment, which is 150-kilowatt power buoy, is what we call it, and that device will be connected to the grid pursuant to a FERC license that we've applied for, which will also be the first in the U.S. Our plan is then to build an additional 9, or total of 10, of these 150-kilowatt devices here in Oregon. The first one of those 10 is nearing completion and will be finally assembled shortly here in Oregon. We've also worked very hard to work with all of the stakeholders to plot out a plan for responsible use of the ocean. We went through the Oregon Solutions process over a 3-year period, and that resulted in a settlement agreement with 11 state and federal agencies and 3 NGO groups last year. This 10-buoy project is a critical step, not just for OPT, but also for the industry, because we've agreed to do a whole series of studies to look at the effect of these kinds of projects on whales, on birds, on salmon, on all the various species that could potentially be affected by this, as well as things like sediment transport and the EMF emissions and acoustic emissions. We can't study that unless we actually put some of these devices in the water. Otherwise, it's all computer modeling, and we're never going to be able to satisfy people that we can move to a full-scale commercial project without having actually studied the effects of these. So we propose to do 10 of these. It is very expensive to do because this is early-stage technology, and we've now completed or nearing completion of this first buoy, and we'll be putting it in the water at Reedsport by the end of this year, in the fall or late summer. We believe we're delivering on the promise that we made to deliver good jobs in Oregon. We have been using Oregon Ironworks to assemble the steel superstructure of our devices. They hired 35 people to help build this first buoy, and it's a massive steel structure that's about 140 feet long and about 36 feet in diameter. We've also used some coastal companies on the South Coast to do some of this work. We've been using American Bridge. We recently let a contract to them for some subsurface floats that are part of the mooring system. And we've also hired Sauce Brothers down at Coos Bay to do the deployment and the maintenance of the buoy. And we will soon be letting another contract up in the Portland vicinity for final assembly of the buoy and to then put it in the water, and actually it'll be towed all the way down the coast to the port of Coos Bay sometime later this year. It should be quite a sight. The funding for this project is challenging, of course, and the first buoy, plus all of the permitting costs and the costs of bringing together all of the stakeholders and doing all of the studies necessary for that, cost over $12 million. OPT put in $7 million of that from its own money, along with some partnership shares from companies like PNGC Power, who I believe is represented here today. I want to thank them for being such a long-term supporter of our project. And also have gotten a significant amount of money from the U.S. Department of Energy, about $4.4 million. We received about $800,000 from the Oregon Betsy program as well to put that first buoy in the water. However, in order to do the other nine and to connect it to the grid, that's going to cost tens of millions of additional dollars. And for that, we hope to get a substantial portion of that from both private funding and also from the U.S. Department of Energy, so that the vast majority of it would come from those two sources. However, the U.S. Department of Energy requires a match from non-federal sources for any money they put up. So we're trying to find ways to work with the state of Oregon to help us put together that match for DOE money. Effectively, what that means is any money that Oregon puts up, any dollar that the state puts up, would be leveraged about a two-for-one basis by a combination of federal money and state and private money. So we think it's a very effective use of Oregon dollars for jobs, and all of the money that we're putting into building these is really going to create jobs in Oregon, a tremendous economic development tool. So I will stop there, and we'll have to just imagine what the buoy looks like. I had great pictures, and hopefully we'll show it to you some other time.
Yeah, I'm sorry that hasn't worked. We'll make sure that the committee staff supplies the committee with an electronic version of your presentation, unless that's it.
There it is. Yeah.
I'll just show you the one picture of the buoy under construction, so you can see that. On the upper left-hand corner is actually what it looked like while it was under construction. On the right-hand side, you can see two of the major pieces. Those two pieces and the one that you see in the bottom left are the three main pieces of the superstructure of the device. The yellow one on the upper right, that's the float. That's the only part of the device that will be above the water line, and it'll be 2.5 miles out in the ocean, so you really won't be able to see it from shore. The bottom right is what we call a heave plate. It's really for ballast. It's in the deep ocean, probably about 150 feet under the surface. And that spar, that cylindrical piece on the bottom left, will be almost entirely under the water as well. That's oriented vertically and stays stable, and the float moves up and down on that cylinder. So it's going to be, you can tell from the flatbed that's under it, it's quite large, and it'll be quite the visual coming down the coast and being towed into port. So we're looking forward to that later this year. Thank you very much.
I'm sure the committee will have questions. I want to note that if they're related to regulatory barriers, we will be discussing Representative Boone's bill, and I don't know if any of you are planning to come up and testify on that. You're certainly welcome to, but we'll be talking about that following the conclusion of this informational meeting. But
I just wanted to ask you, if we could get a copy electronically of your presentation, too. So
certainly.
That'd be great.
You have a copy.
Oh, we do.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Any questions for the committee?
On there.
Well, thank you very much for your being here and for that overview. We'll move to the second panel, Mayor Timchuk from Reedsport, Commissioner Labhart from Tillamook County, and Dave Sabala from Douglas County, I assume, Douglas Electric Co-op. Come on up.
No, I don't think I'd like to test it out.
Gentlemen, in any order, I don't know if you...
I think Mark is the highest-ranking member of the committee.
Okay, thank you, Chair Cannon and Chair Gilliam. For the record, I'm Mark Labhart, and I have the privilege of being a Tillamook County Commissioner. I'd like to just digress in my 5 minutes to talk about why should we even be worried about this ocean energy stuff. And I'm going to give you an example in Tillamook County that is fairly, I think, consistent with what other counties and... electrical companies are facing. The Tillamook PUD recently signed a 20-year contract with BPA, and that sets their power needs for the next 20 years. BPA has indicated that the Tillamook PUD will not get any more power for the next 20 years other than what they're allocated right at that 20-year contract. So what does that mean? It means that the power load growth, they are going to have to find it from some other source. The Tillamook PUD's power load growth is approximately 2% a year. So in 20 years, they're going to need 40% more power, and they will not get that from BPA. So state law, as you are very familiar with, requires that the Tillamook PUD, for example, will have to receive 5% of its power from renewable resources by the year 2025. Currently, the Tillamook PUD gets about 1% of its power from renewable resources. So, again, they're aggressively working on conservation measures and those kind of things, but clearly they're not going to be able to satisfy that. So there's a need and a desire to look for alternate energy sources. Ocean energy is a place where they can do that. So what we've done in Tillamook County is, back in 2007, we formed TIDE. TIDE stands for Tillamook Intergovernmental Development Entity. It is a 190 organization, a partnership between the county and the PUD for several purposes. One is to assure that the protection of ocean resources off of our coastline is taken into account for future generations, assure that Tillamook County citizens have a role and an opportunity to provide input regarding the development of ocean energy off of our coastline, provide leadership for the responsible development of ocean energy, gather from communities in Tillamook a framework for the development of ocean energy, and this one is really important, secure partnerships with public agencies, including state agencies, and private entities for the responsible development of ocean energy. And so we want to partner with DLCD, DSL, federal agencies to what happens off of our coastline. Jason Bush mentioned two companies. Aquamarine is seriously looking at Tillamook County right now. There's another company called Principal Power, and they have an offshore device that is essentially it's a wind on water device. The Department of Energy just recently said that they're going to release, and I'll just quote from their press statement, The Department of Energy issued three separate solicitation documents totaling $50.5 million in funding, and they have a request for proposals out right now to do three things off the coastlines of the United States. They have $25 million for technology development, and they're soliciting support for the development of innovative wind turbine design projects offshore. Remove market barriers, $18.5 million for support of baseline studies. And then the third one is $7.5 million for next generation technology on wind on water devices. Principal Power, we're in negotiations with them right now under an IGA to look at a wind on water device. They are currently putting a device in Portugal right now. They are very serious about putting a device 8 to 10 miles offshore of Tillamook. And so we're working with them on that and also having discussions with Aquamarine.
I'd like to thank the chairs, the co-chairs, and the members of the committee for allowing me to present today. And I'd say it's a pleasure to be on this side of the dais. We recently had a city council meeting, and I was on that side, of course, and got beat up for wastewater rates, so it's really enjoyable to sit on this side for once. My name is Keith Timchuk. I'm the mayor of Reedsport. I've been involved with Wave Power in one way or another for the last 6 years. I had the great privilege of hosting the first Wave Power Summit, I think in the United States, certainly in Oregon, 6 years ago. From there, I was asked to be one of the original presenters to the Oregon Innovation Council and make a pitch for the state to support Wave Power. I did that. That, was a pleasure, and we were quite successful. And then beyond that, I was asked to be one of the co-conveners for the Oregon Solutions Process for OPT's Reedsport Wave Park application, and I had the great honor of serving with State Senator Joanne Verger in that capacity as well. My job here, of course, today is to talk about jobs on the coast, as Mark has mentioned, and I think there's a need to educate all of you who are more well aware than I of the need for jobs in Oregon, especially on the coast. A year ago, I looked at an unemployment set of figures for the state of Oregon, and if I remember correctly, all of the state's leading counties in unemployment were coastal counties, and Mark might be able to vouch for that. So jobs on the coast are absolutely would absolutely be a godsend. Wave power development has the opportunity to do that. I think we can do wave power development in a way that is sensitive to those people who already use the ocean resource and have done so for a long time. And I think that's one of the great intents of marine spatial planning, and we're moving forward in a way that will allow that. OPT, of course, has identified Reedsport. That was serendipitously. I didn't have anything to do with that identification, but we happen to have all of the infrastructure. We happen to have the nearby substations, and we happen to have the ocean bottom that they needed, as well as the wave resources. From that, Reedsport has been centrally involved over the past 5 years. The people on the coast, I think, are ready for wave power development to prove itself or not prove itself. I happen to think it will. And I think as it proves itself, when we're going to get jobs from the deployment, from the maintenance of those devices. And as Bob Lurie spoke about, and as you saw, they are indeed significant devices. There's a great set of videos available on YouTube from a television show called Green Economy TV that showed the building of the device at Oregon Ironworks and talked about the cost of the device and purely the amount of material that went into the device that was purchased from Oregon companies. So if you talk about $3 to $4 million to build one, you got nearly $1 million in material that came from Oregon companies to go right into that device. It's creating jobs in Oregon now, wave power is. Oregon is uniquely poised. We have some things here that do not exist elsewhere in the world. We have the Oregon Wave Energy Trust. I don't think you'll find that anywhere else in the United States. Oregon State University, of course, has the Hinsdale Wave Research Center, which is unique to the United States. The largest. It also has the largest test bed for wave energy devices in the United States. We now have the National Marine Renewable Energy Lab for wave power, which is now at Oregon State. There is no state better poised, more ready for wave power development in the United States than Oregon is, and I urge us all to take advantage of that. And I mentioned in an interview I did for television a couple of months ago that I would love to see every job in Oregon created in my backyard, right in Reedsport. And some of them will be. Some of the jobs are going to come to American Bridge right in my backyard, and some of those are going to go to Soss Brothers in Coos Bay. But as you know, and as those of us on the coast know, that a rising tide floats all boats. And if those jobs are created in Tillamook, that helps Reedsport. And if those jobs are created in Reedsport, that helps the county commissioner next to me. And if those jobs are created at Sauce Brothers in Coos Bay, that helps Reedsport as well. And while I'd like to control it and put all the investment right in Reedsport, that's unreasonable, but there are jobs to be had here, and they'll benefit my community. And I wanted to mention, I hadn't thought about this until it was mentioned by Jason Bush, and he mentioned Columbia Power Technologies, which is a new company in this field headquartered in Corvallis. Those are jobs that are created because of this industry. 6 years ago, when I had the opportunity to host the first Wave Power Summit in Oregon, all the principals for that were graduate students at Oregon State University. And because of Oregon State's program, and because of Oregon's unique situation, they were able to leave school with their graduate degrees, create a company that's creating jobs in this state right now. The benefit from Wave Power Technology is real, and it's here, and let's take advantage of it. And Paul Claren commented on his excellent Citizen's Guide to the Territorial Sea Plan. I think you read a bit of that. And I'd encourage you all to chase down a copy from Paul. It's 4 pages. It's really concise, but it explains the process of where Oregon is. And if Paul wouldn't mind, I'm going to quote real quickly from his paper, and then I will be done. On the same day, the state of Oregon and FERC signed a memorandum of understanding to, and I quote, to coordinate the procedures and schedules for review of wave energy projects in the territorial sea of Oregon and to ensure that there is coordinated review of proposed wave energy projects that is responsive to the environmental, economic, and cultural concerns that is happening while providing a timely and stable and predictable means for developers of such projects to seek necessary approvals. Timely is the word I emphasize. The time is here. The time is now. Let's move forward with wave power in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Cannon, Chair Gillum, members of the committee, my name is Dave Sabala. I'm the general manager of Douglas Electric Co-op, headquartered in Roseburg, Oregon, and appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. So now I need to turn this thing up. I'm here today to give the utility perspective, and when I say electric utility perspective, I'm talking on behalf of Douglas Electric Co-op and PNGC Power. PNGC, who is a participant in the OPT Reedsport Wave Project off the coast of Gardner, is a generation and transmission cooperative. Douglas Electric's a member of PNGC, as are West Oregon Electric Co-op, headquartered in Vernonia, CPI, headquartered in Philomath, Coos Curry Electric, headquartered in Port Orford, who are in some of your districts. PNGC is a power pool supply management, does power supply management for its members, and may purchase some of the power from the OPT Reedsport Wave Project in its demonstration station phase. Douglas Electric has a secondary role, and that is we also are the interconnecting utility to interconnect OPT to the BPA grid. This is a Paul, or Bob didn't have a time or a chance to show the interconnection, but basically the project's located two and three-quarter miles, as I understand it, out in the ocean, comes terrestrially onto the ground, goes a couple of miles, and then it interconnects with Douglas Electric Co-op's existing power line, and then we take it a modest 1 mile and deliver it to the BPA Gardner substation. So we're quite modest in this project in terms of our role as an interconnecting utility. From our perspective, why wave power? Basically, we need the power. If you take the long view, because my kids are having kids, my parents had me, you know, just due to population growth, we'll need more power down the road. And we'll need to meet it from lots of different sources, including new resources, conventional resources, energy efficiency programs, demand response. We sort of need it all because our kids are having kids. And I am happy to announce that my fifth grandchild is going to be coming out on, I said that wrong, is March 31st. Yeah. So go ahead, tell me. I look too young to have five grandchildren.
You do.
Absolutely.
Wave Power's emerging technology, and OPT in particular, is fairly advanced in the product development curve. That's why PNGC was interested in OPT. We're interested because of the predictability we perceive from Wave Power. There are data buoys a considerable distance out in the ocean, and we can take a look at those data a day ahead or 2 days ahead, and we can predict amount of generation 1 or 2 days ahead of time. Wave projects, we believe they'll have a higher generation factor than some of the other renewables, such as wind and solar. And they're scalable. We think that these kind of projects can scale, where we can you know, develop smaller increments and grow with our load growth over time. The one thing I would say is the project, the first buoy is due out this summer, as Bob said. It actually won't be grid connected. It is the grid connected parts due the summer of 2012, and that's when it'd be grid connected. But what we really believe is, to understand these projects, you need to have a project in the water. This is a estimated energy availability, and what it does is it sort of matches the West Coast loads in Western Oregon that tend to peak in the winter, like now, as opposed in the summer. Well, the wave projects do that as well. I'm not going to ask you to take a test on this map, so you won't have to memorize it, but basically what it is most of the generation in the Northwest is on the east side of the Cascades, and then we use transmission lines to transport them to where most of the load is on the west side. These projects are on the west side where the load is, most of the load is, and so we think that's a distinct advantage for these kind of projects because they're close to where the load is. Jason indicated earlier that OWED completed a study this summer under the Utility Marketing Initiative for Wave Power, and there's about 500 megawatts of transmission capacity up and down the Oregon coast. It's dispersed. That means you can plug in one place to the grid and do 500 megawatts and need to be dispersed. But that's a significant amount of capacity to develop wave power, and so without major transmission grid upgrades. Our payoff for a successful demonstration project would be to verify that it's a has viability as a renewable resource. We can confirm its generation predictability, as I mentioned before, know the O&M cost characteristics, reduce integration complexity, verify its scalability, confirm compatibility with other ocean uses, and then confirm environmental good stewardship. And that concludes my report.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions from the committee? Great. Seeing none, I think we'll move on. Appreciate you all being here and traveling yourselves some distance to be here. We'll close the informational meeting on ocean energy, and we're going to move into a public hearing on our ocean energy-related bill, House Bill 2748, and ask Representative Boone. And anyone you want to bring up, Representative Boone, we have Jason Bush back from Wave Energy Trust. You want to come on up as well?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and I would like to just take a second to thank everybody who's came before me on the informational hearing. And we, as you can see, we have a lot of expertise in our state right now, and things are happening. One of the things that I wanted to point out was the bill, the 2748 that we're hearing now, is part of a series of bills that I've been personally involved with, from the seafloor mapping to the spatial planning and the encouraging the seafloor territorial sea mapping update to include ocean energy. We have a very talented and experienced crew in the agencies who are doing this work, and longtime people who know our oceans and know it well. So I applaud what the work they're doing to help this move forward. And my one last point of that, it's kind of all fits together in a plan. It's a big puzzle, I know, and it's a lot of stuff to assimilate. But even our community colleges along the coast are getting involved in this effort, developing curriculum that will pop out some many mechanical engineers who will be our workforce in this sector. So I just want to thank everybody behind me and for coming out today and helping. And my bill, 2748, is really a very simple bill. It's another tool in that toolbox that the energy sector, ocean energy sector, is going to need to move forward. And it's almost exactly the same language as 2009's version of Senate Bill 195. And what it does is basically extend the sunset another 10 years so that in that time frame, the device developers and everybody who's working on this effort collectively and collaboratively can have what they need to get the information, the data they need for this this project. So I would like to have Jason, who is an attorney and can understand a lot of the language that we're reading in these bills as we move forward, and wonder what happened to Chuck Riley's plain language bill. I don't know. Anyway, the reason I brought this forward is that we saw a need to have this sunset extended to enable this whole movement forward in our puzzle. So thank you very much, and I will let my colleague here.
Thank you, Representative Boone, and thank you, Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. Again, my name is Jason Bush, Executive Director of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust. I don't have much to add on this except that the law ORS 543.014 effectively functions as a de facto moratorium on ocean energy on our shores. This language it certainly predates the industry of ocean energy, probably never foresaw that it would apply to ocean energy, but it does because we're regulated by the Water Resources Division and for hydro. And so it would prevent us to deploy a grid-connected device in Oregon. We had a short window of exemption under SB 195 2 years ago that has sunsetted, and this bill simply extends it from the current date until 2021, 10 years, which provides a reasonable time frame within which two or more projects could be grid-connected in Oregon. A project could start in 2012, but by the time you build 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 of them, it would be years down the road, and this would apply for that period of time.
Great. Committee, these are the only folks who have signed up to testify, so questions on this bill would be appropriate to them, and if they can't answer, maybe there's somebody else in the room who can. Representative
Krieger. I was out of the room, excuse me a minute, but fill and removal, Vision State Land, you put something out there, you got to be taking it back. What kind of a bond are they going to have to put up to assure that if these things don't work, they don't abandon them out there, and they have to have the capacity to remove them? And who does that? Who has machines big enough to do that?
That's an excellent question. It's certainly beyond the scope of this language, and I'm not sure I'm in the position to actually know all the details of all the permittings. The flow chart for permitting in ocean energy is hugely complex, and I only know some of it. So
you're getting the expert here.
We have a consultant here.
Sandy.
Chair Cannon and Representative Krieger.
Introduce yourself for the record. Please.
Louise Soliday, Department of State Lands. The department has adopted rules for wave energy devices on the heels of the 2007 statutes that were passed, and a part of that is that we require financial assurance for those devices so that in the event something happens, and I'll use the example, Finavera put a buoy out there 2 summers ago, and unfortunately it sank. We were holding their financial assurance, which assured us that they were going to remove the buoy from the bottom of the ocean, and they did do that, and we released their financial assurance. So we do require that financial assurance to ensure that if something does happen or we get to the end of the life of these projects, that what is placed there will be removed.
Hold on.
How do you calculate? Is it a bond or something of this nature? Now, you know, you put one out there, that's one thing. But if you put an array, let's say 10, of course, being around the coast for 67 years. Yeah, I'm 70, so I've been there for 67 years.
Okay.
Anyway, these things go around and around like crab pots, and pretty soon I can see them all tangled up together. Oh, my God, what do you got now? I'm really interested to watch it. I hope I live long enough to see this thing out there.
So, Chair Cannon, Representative Krieger, we accept a variety of different financial assurances, bonding, CDs. So we have a number of instruments that people can use depending on the situation. And I think we don't have experience with more than one device yet, and so we haven't faced that. But I think we understand the concerns about having a bunch of wave energy devices that are abandoned out there and the potential impacts that they could have with existing users. And so I think we'll be looking at that issue very closely in terms of what we think the value of that financial assurance needs to be to ensure that there's enough in the event that somebody abandons that we have the resources to remove whatever might be left there.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I
have a couple of questions, somewhat technical, on this bill. This basically duplicates the language that was in Senate Bill 195 from 2009. Why did that bill have a 1-year sunset? Why did we not deal with this at that time and push it all the way to 2021 or whatever is proposed here?
I can't answer that. Right now, I could find out for you. That was a Senate bill, and
that's the answer.
There you go. All right. Yeah,
I'd be happy to find out. But it was a window of opportunity we needed to get that. It was part of the process OPT was going through and getting that test in the water. So.
Okay. And then a second, and this is maybe just a drafting question, but the way this has been drafted, it creates a new. It doesn't modify the existing exemption for wave energy. It sort of supplements in a different... And I don't understand why, as a matter of law, we haven't added to the existing exemption. I mean, if you look at Section 2 of the bill, a wave energy project that does not qualify under ORS 543.014 is exempt if blah, 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 blah. Why didn't the drafting... Why didn't we simply... change ORS 543.014 to assure that these types of projects would qualify under that exemption. Do you understand my question?
I do. I think that certainly to defer to Representative Boone, but would certainly be amenable to the idea of simply amending the language and get rid of the sunsetting altogether. That's probably the only element would need to be removed, and it would simply provide the exemption.
Okay.
The difference is between 114 and 114.2 is whether it's subject to license under Federal Power Act.
Right.
That's the only difference in the criteria between 1 and 2.
Okay. That's helpful. Anything further on this? Fishing communities okay with moving forward in this way?
This process, we've been moving forward, and as we do on the coast, we work with all the stakeholders. And as it moves forward, I think you heard a little bit earlier from Mayor Timchuk, they spent on their... in their process of 3 years coming to a settlement through the Oregon Solutions Project where all the stakeholders were at the table. And it's just the way we do things on the coast. We want to make sure it's done right. So that's the things that you're hearing today. This is Mr. Sabala said, birthed. And these are the grandchildren or the children coming on right now.
Thank you, Representative Boone. Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, just a brief comment, because I don't get a chance to put on the record very often. I'm not from the coast. I don't know the coastal communities like Representative Boone or other members of this committee do, but I do know a little bit about market development, and this is very, very exciting. And the fact is that when you have strong public sector planning combined with private sector entrepreneurship and nonprofits that are facilitating and helping organize an emerging technology around a unique Oregon resource and industry, that is very exciting and hopefully an answer for jobs in the state. So thank you all for your work on it, and thank you, Representative Boone, for your leadership.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Bailey. That's exactly what it is, and I think Jason mentioned the 13,000 jobs that we hope to see eventually from this build-out in the sector. But we're using Oregon people, Oregon workforce, Oregon products and manufacturing and the movement of getting things around. It's very innovative. The device developers have been very open to doing just that, and I think that this is truly an Oregon project, the whole thing. I mean, overview of the whole thing, but OWET has been instrumental in picking up the pieces for the collection of data, and they do a lot of the stuff that you don't hear about. It's behind the scenes to set things in motion so that when things do need to move forward, it's taken care of, and it's been a very nice collaborative effort.
Great.
Thank you, and thanks for your words.
Thanks. With that, a good way to close our public hearing on House Bill 2748 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2864. Pull the Representative Huffman, I hope, will help kick us off on this bill.
Greetings.
Hey.
Co-chairs, committee members, John Huffman, state rep for District 59. If this entire testimony were up to me, I could speak very technically about hydropower, but I know I'd be speaking over co-chair Gilliam's head, so I won't do that. I will.
Is that directed at me?
So I would just say good bill should pass, but I won't do that either. I'm actually here to thank the committee for hearing my bill and to ask you to please welcome some of my constituents from Northern Wasco County Public Utility District, and I'm actually going to let them come up and be the experts, but thank you, committee.
Great. So we'll have Tom Barrows, Dwight Langer, and Tom O'Connor, if you want to come up as well. We can do this by panel or begin with the two of you. You're here. Tom's on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Barrows, representing Northern Wasco County People's Utility District. I'm just going to give you a little brief history of the issue that House Bill 2864 deals with, and then Mr. Langer will go through sort of the particulars. I was brought on in 2007 to deal with the RPS, the impact that might have on a couple small utilities. One of the things that by the time I came on, the date of 1995 for inclusion had already been set, and try as I might, I wasn't able to get that moved at all. I understand that was all an agreement. The problem was we had a small utility that had a facility on that had come online in 1991. To help fish and provide some energy, and so wasn't able to get that included. Came back in 2009 with an amendment to one of the other bills that was presented. There were a number of amendments dealing with the RPS at that time, and the ultimate result was most of those were just not even dealt with. So came back in 2010 with an amendment to another bill. Had agreement from most of the impacted people that they didn't have a problem with the bill as long as it's narrowly drawn. It's, we believe, only applies to this utility, this facility, and one other very small one, less than about a half a megawatt in Ashland. So, but the proponents of that bill did not want the amendment added, thought it would create confusion, so we backed off and now are here with a standalone bill that we believe just deals with these two small utilities. Spoken with what I thought, I tried to find all the impact parties, spoke with Jeff Bissonette, as long as it was narrowly drawn, Cub was fine with it. Spoke with Margie Hoffman, they were fine as long as it was narrowly drawn. And with the inclusion of Ashland that we discovered this year, very small, I've gone back to those folks and verified that there may be another utility that's impacted, and I've gotten Tom O'Connor's answer that it looks like it does qualify under this. So we're talking about a total of about 5 megawatts with the two facilities. That'll turn over to Dwight.
Honorable co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to address the committee with regards to House Bill 2864. My name is Dwight Langer. I'm general manager for Northern Wasco County PUD, located in the Dalles. Our service territory is approximately 80 miles east of Portland, and our northern service boundary is the mighty Columbia River. We serve over 9,800 retail customers, of which 93% are single-phase customers. While 87% of our energy is purchased from the Bonneville Power Administration, the PUD owns and operates two small hydroelectric generation projects, one being the Dalles Hydro, the other being the McNary Hydro Project. In addition, our conservation programs have achieved energy savings of over 18 million kilowatt hours and an investment of $2.8 million in customer rebates and incentives. Our total energy portfolio is nearly 100% carbon free. My comments today in support of House Bill 2864 pertain to the Dalles Hydro Project. The PUD's project is located at the Dalles Dam. Planning for the eventual construction of this project began August 4, 1983, with the FERC issuance of a preliminary permit. Actual construction began in 1989, and we produced our first commercial power May 28, 1991. From start to finish, this was at least an eight-year process and a result of much dedicated, diligent work and at a total project cost of over $15 million. Such projects by PUDs, can only be taken under, after, and with the approval from its customers. In a public referendum, this project received over 70% approval from our customers to proceed. The district's customers still have outstanding revenue bonds for the construction of this project. The project generates 4.5 average megawatts per year. I'd refer the committee's attention to two photographs that are attached to the back of my testimony. And you can see by the first photo, the area photo, that the footprint for our facilities is small in comparison to the larger surrounding federal dam and its structures. The PUD's intake and dewatering structure improves juvenile fish passage condition by diverting fish away from the auxiliary water system. The Dalles Hydro has been heralded for its fish-friendly attributes and unique design. When you look at the photographs, the bottom photograph, you can see the structure to the right is actually the staircase leading to our project. The round circular structure that you see in the bottom photograph is actually the cap. Underneath, that's the size of the generator. If we would need to pull the generator for maintenance or for other purposes, this cap is removable and you would actually put a crane in and pull it out. This is the size. It's small. I mean, we're talking, this is not a big project. It's a nice looking project, but it's small. And the top photograph, is, as I pointed out earlier, is obviously an aerial photograph that puts the powerhouse from the lower project in perspective with the surrounding facilities and grounds of the federal Dalles Hydro Project. You can see the north fish ladder, the screened intake. It is labeled there. And in between the intake and the north fish ladder, you see a juvenile bypass. Now, what that is, and it runs actually out of the photograph, you can't see all of it, that is a water slide. For any smolts that would be screened off, they would actually be captured and sent down this water slide around all of the generation projects and put into back into the Columbia River, completely unharmed and unscathed. As I pointed out earlier, the project has been heralded and received many complimentary awards from fisheries for its fish-friendly and fish passage attributes. The Dalles project does not qualify under our state's renewable portfolio standards solely because it was in operation prior to 1995. This is unfortunate, and we ask your consideration to allow our community to include the Dalles Fishway Hydro Project towards meeting our obligations under the terms of the state's renewable portfolio standard requirements and send House Bill 2864 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. See if there are any questions. I just have one. So if this project had come online January 2nd of 1995, it would qualify for the RPS.
Yes, sir.
Might understand then that it is a certified as low-impact hydro, or am I misreading the law?
Actually, Co-Chairman Gannon, we do have an application before the Low Impact Hydro Institute for it to be certified as low impact hydro. We're not, that's not an inexpensive process. We've got probably $10,000 invested in the process now. We believe that it will be certified. However, the cost for that going forward, we do not know what those fees will be in the future, whether the criteria will change. It just puts at risk, we feel, a project that is very environmentally complementary to Fish Passage.
Okay. Thank you. Uh-huh. Appreciate it. We have a couple other folks signed up to testify. So Jim Myron and Doug Barber.
Thank you.
So, Tom, why don't you come on up here as well? You're also on the list.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Myron, representing Water Watch of Oregon. You will have soon a statement in opposition to this bill. Let me just explain what Water Watch's concerns were. And first of all, at the time that our testimony was developed, we had no information about any particular projects that might be covered by this bill or the number of projects that might be affected. So the concerns that Water Watch has were based on the exemption from certain provisions of the RPS standard and the exemption from the certification process. So that's primarily the reason why Water Watch was opposed to this bill. What I will do is, with the information I have gained today from listening to the testimony, I will try and develop some more information to bring back to my client to see if we want to reconsider or add to our testimony now that we have some information about the projects.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber, here today representing a coalition of small non-utility irrigation districts, hydroelectric producers. They're mostly irrigation districts, the Warm Springs Tribe, private producers. It's a group that came together in 2009 and 2010 to sponsor House Bill 3649 that you passed in the February 2010 session unanimously in both chambers, and it became law at that time. You have in front of you a letter from the Farmers Irrigation District, which one of the members of the coalition. And I'll just try to summarize the issues that Mike Kleinsmith raises in that letter. Basically, the coalition of hydroelectric providers that I represent wanted what the North Wasco project already has, and that is the right to be part of Oregon's RPS if they get certified as low-impact hydro. We fought for that, you gave it to us, and it works. We have now four of our projects have been certified by the Low-Impact Hydro Institute. All of those projects are now either selling their RECs or are in the process they have to go through a certification process to sell them, but that it provides a revenue stream for them to reinvest in their project, to make their project more environmentally sound, to enhance the environmental attributes of the project. It did exactly what we were hoping it would do. It works. It works for us, and we believe it will work for North Wasco. All they have to do is get certified. And so we think it's a mistake for the legislature to step in and pick out this project here or that project there and say, no, you don't have to get certified, or no, you don't have to get certified. That if by doing that, it ultimately would devalue RECs for all of us. So we ask you to oppose the bill.
I appreciate your point, Mr. Barber, but isn't it also the case that they would have trouble with the date, the 95 date, even if they were to get certified?
No. Chair Cannon, the 95 date was, as I understand it, and I'm no specialist on the RPS, but the 95 date said that for utility-owned projects, from 95 forward, they didn't have to get certified. From 95 back, they did. It's the way I understand.
Okay.
And so they have to be certified low-impact hydro, and that was the standard that we were being held to and that we are held to. And so when we wrote the bill last session, the distinction in the law was whether you were owned by a utility or not owned by a utility. And we said that this is about environmental attributes. It's not about who owns the project. The question should be, is it a green project? And so what was added was, if it doesn't matter if it's utility-owned or non-utility-owned, if you are low-impact hydro-certified, then you qualify.
Okay, I'm reading the underlying statute a different way, but there may be provisions that I'm not paying attention to. Representative Bailey.
Not to preempt your comment, Mr. Chair, but just to say that this seems like a pretty important, pivotal determination to make in the testimony. Perhaps staff could follow up with us.
Yeah, I think that's right, because I would appreciate a little more clarity on that particular point. I think the question is whether the current law would permit the qualification of a facility that went operational before 95 and obtained the certification for low impact. And I understand your testimony to mean yes, they would qualify.
Sure.
And I am reading it's the bottom of page one of our bill. I should say the ORS site 469A.020. I'm reading it differently, but I may be missing the whole, so we'll need clarification on that. Mr. O'Connor, do you want to add your thoughts here?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom O'Connor. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. I'm here to speak in support of this legislation. The sponsor mentioned, the city of Ashland, which is a small municipal electric utility, has a very small hydro facility, produces about a capacity of about 750 kilowatt hours on their existing water supply system. The water supply system has been in place since the early 1900s. There was a little hydro unit there in the early 1900s that was eventually abandoned. In 90, the city looking for more sources of renewable energy put in a little reconstituted the little hydro facility there on the water supply system. It serves it doesn't go out on the grid. It only serves the city of into the city of Ashland. We would be in support of this legislation. In response to what's been said, let me clarify a couple of things, at least that I think maybe are important. We think are important anyway. One, why are we here? We're here because we have, and Northern Wasco has, a compliance obligation under the Renewable Portfolio Standard. We are not here because we're looking for to sell RECs on the market. We have a compliance obligation, unlike the other actors that have been mentioned. It's a small compliance obligation. We're small utilities. These are small facilities. They're in the grand scheme of things to larger utilities, they're a gnat. But to us, they mean something. Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I seriously doubt that the vast pool of RECs within the Western interconnection would be diluted by two small hydro facilities in Oregon. I would point out that under the RPS that we passed, which our organization in the city of Ashland supported from day one, renewable energy certificates, which are used to comply with the RPS, may come from projects anywhere within the United States portion of the Western interconnection. That's basically west of the Rockies. So projects all over that area are eligible for our RPS. And Bonneville, just as another thing to add, Bonneville estimates that here in the Northwest alone, by 2018, we're going to be interconnecting to Bonneville 12,000 megawatts of wind just in the Bonneville area alone. So I hope that puts some of this in context. These two small projects would be valuable to us, to these two small utilities for our compliance obligation. I don't think that they would harm anyone else's situation, and I urge your support.
Thanks. Question? All right. Well, it looks like that is it. Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. And with that, seeing no one else who wants to testify, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2864. And we'll close the Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. Thanks.